This is Edward October, host of October Pod on YouTube. Hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle, or a home invader looking for an open window, a jilted lover looking for revenge, or a disgruntled co-worker hoping to spike your eggnog with arsenic. The girls of our true crime podcast are always on Santa's nice list, but the crimes they discuss are very naughty indeed. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
It's day 12. Yay.
The final day. And poor Nico.
Saint Nico. He's been canonized. I don't know if you know that, but he has.
Canonized, yes. He is the patron saint of audio.
Audio, yes. Also the patron saint of dealing with two dingy broads. So there's that.
Yep. He had the roughest time with all of it.
TDB. TDB for short. Right?
Yeah. He's fantastic. If you guys need anybody to make music for your podcast or do your sound and editing for you for your podcast, give Nico at Week Talk of Dreams a holla.
All right. Well, what do you got for us? What do you got?
Today, we're going to talk about a little known serial killer that hit the Buffalo, New York area in the early 80s.
Hmm.
Just 3 years after the Son of Sam murders had terrorized New York, Buffalo was hit with the same kind of surprise attack killer, but this murderer preferred killing black men.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
And it's kind of funny because the Son of Sam, before they found out, you know, before they called him Son of Sam, they called him the .44 caliber killer.
Right.
This person killed with .22 caliber.
So they call them the firearms. .22 caliber killer.
Very good. Yes, they're very creative up east in the 80s. Yeah. So let's begin. On the evening of September 20th, 1980, Larry Robinson and Glenn Dunn went to the grocery store in Buffalo, New York, so Larry could cash his paycheck. Glenn said he'd just wait outside and have a smoke. Around 9:40 p.m., a nurse who had just gotten off her shift pulled into the parking lot, and as she was walking inside, she noticed Glenn, who was kind of standing under the lamppost, kind of made her uncomfortable. So she hurried up and went into the store because there had been a rash of robberies in the area, and she was just kind of leery, and she didn't want to be the next person robbed.
Mm-hmm.
So Larry, he wasn't in the store for very long, and he comes out to hop into Glenn's car, but he noticed that the door was locked, so he started pounding on the window and calling Glenn's name, and there's no reaction from Glenn. So Larry goes around to the driver's side, and he notices that Glenn has blood coming from somewhere on his head, just coming down his head, and he's not responding.
It's not a good sign.
Larry then rushes back to the grocery store and has them call for help, and within minutes, the police and an ambulance arrive. Well, the nurse at this time was just walking back out, and she stopped and she asked security, you know, is there anything I can do? And they said no, and they just sent her back home. Although paramedics did everything they could to save Glenn, his heart had stopped, and they found out later that he had 3 bullets to the head.
Oh.
And honestly, Glenn pretty much died before he reached the hospital. Come to find out, he was only 14 years old. Police checked the car and the surrounding area for clues, and the only thing they found were spent bullet casings from a .22 caliber weapon. So the next day, police get a call from someone who lived close by the grocery store, and they claim to have seen the shooter. When police go to her house to speak with her, she tells them that around 9:45, she heard 3 gunshots or popping sounds. When she went to look outside, she saw a white man running from a parked car. She couldn't clearly see his face because he had the hood up on his sweatshirt. The other witness that came forward was the nurse. She described what she saw. She saw Glenn standing outside his car. Then she saw the man sitting outside the store. And when they asked to describe the man, she said she saw a thin white man with dark hair, wire glasses, but his face, she couldn't really get a good look at it because he had the hood of his sweatshirt up. She also commented that he was holding a paper bag on his lap and had this really weird, dazed look. And she said she remembered that look because as she was walking to inside the store, she was alone in the parking lot. So she was kind of keeping an eye on everyone to make sure that if there was trouble, maybe she could find somebody for help. Mm-hmm. But when she saw this man, she saw the funny look on his face. She's like, well, yeah, I'm kind of alone in all this, you know. After the detectives spoke with the witnesses, they get another call about another shooting. This time, 32-year-old Harold Green was eating lunch in his car at a fast food restaurant when a man walked up and shot him point blank. An employee at the restaurant heard the shots and saw a white man in a hooded sweatshirt running away carrying a paper bag.
In the paper bag, is that the gun?
He's hiding the gun in the paper bag, okay. Yeah. Since this crime scene was similar to the one the evening before, the detectives went to search to see if somehow Harold and Glenn were connected in any way. Harold was a 32-year-old professional black man, and Glenn was a 14-year-old. They had nothing in common besides their skin color. They didn't know any of the same people, nothing. The only thing that linked the two together were the .22 caliber bullet casings found at the scene. Later that night, detectives were alerted again of another shooting. This time, 30-year-old Emmanuel Thomas was shot while crossing the street to his own home, only 7 blocks away from where Glenn Dunn was killed. This time there was a teen who saw the whole event happen. He saw a white hooded male, approximately 5'8 or 5'9, run up, raise a paper bag, and then shoot Emmanuel on the left side of his head. The only thing left at the scene? You guessed it, .22 caliber bullet casings. And the only thing linking all three murders were that all the victims were black, they were men, and they had all been shot with a .22 caliber firearm. They had no idea even if it was a pistol or a rifle or what it was. Mm-hmm. But once Emmanuel was on the autopsy table and they looked at the gunpowder burns on his face, they were able to tell that the burns resembled marks that usually were made from a sawed-off shotgun.
That's so fascinating, really, that they can do that.
Isn't it?
It really is.
Isn't it? I'd love to go to school for that, but I don't know if I could stomach it. 3 deaths in a 36-hour period. The press ran with the story and, of course, dubbed the killer the .22 caliber killer because they're very creative. And they stated, since all the men were black, the murderer had to have a racial motivation to do this. Mm-hmm. Not the police, although they did suspect it, but the press ran with that. The day after Emmanuel was killed, 20 miles north of Buffalo in Niagara Falls, 43-year-old Joseph McCoy was shot to death in front of a church. The witness saw a white male in khakis fleeing the scene.
Wow.
Now, police put out a composite sketch, but the problem with the sketch, it looked like your average Joe, yeah, just your regular person on the street. And they received somewhere around 6,000 calls with tips stating who people thought this killer was. Couldn't be fun.
He had a hoodie, right? So they just drew him with the hoodie up. And so there wasn't
nothing
to go on.
He had a hoodie.
But he was a white guy with a hoodie, right?
For the first couple murders.
Oh.
The next one, this one, the composite sketches that I saw, he had on like this fishing type hat, this khaki fishing type hat.
Like a bucket hat. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. But why all the information said a hoodie, I don't know. Hmm. Nobody really ever commented on a bucket hat that I found. But the composite sketch had the bucket hat.
What time of year was it?
September. End of September, right. Beginning of October.
So it's getting a little chilly. So maybe he did have a sweatshirt, mm-hmm, and then that just like mixed in
at
with
night.
The hat. With the hat, mm-hmm, though, you know what I mean? So that it looked like it was a one piece instead of two.
Could be. Well, on October 8th, construction workers in Amherst found an abandoned taxi cab. Oh. The workers called the police, and a state trooper was sent to investigate. The cab was empty, when they searched it, and all they found was a wallet with the license from 71-year-old Parler Edwards. The car basically was left open. The only thing that was locked was the trunk. So the state trooper took a crowbar, popped it open, and inside they found Parler Edwards' bloodied body. They said that he had been bludgeoned to death, and it was so severely beaten that pieces of skull and numerous teeth were in the parking lot where he originally had been kidnapped.
That's awful.
And beaten and then moved. Mm-hmm.
So they think they beat and him and then put him into the trunk?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Ugh.
Also, before the killer threw Parler's body into the trunk of the cab, the killer cut open the victim's chest and took his heart.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You brought out the gruesome for the 12 days. That's terrible.
I know.
But he didn't do that with the other ones. Was that the same guy? Was that the same killer? We don't know yet.
Well,
these are just the ideas I'm thinking. Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Police doubted that this murder was connected to the murders the week prior because the type of weapon that was used and the fact that the, you know, different MO.
It's almost like cut I'm out psychic. The heart. Almost like I'm psychic. I know.
Instead of putting like two or three bullets to somebody's head, the guy actually beat them to unrecognizable mush and then cut their heart out. So they're like, besides the victim being a black man, there was nothing that made the police think that the killer was the same one, unless the killer maybe started progressing.
Getting braver.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just progressed to mutilating his victim's bodies.
He's quick, though. I mean, for that.
I would think so. So pressure from the community grew, of course. The black community was up in arms. They were begging the police to do something. Their whole community was in terror, which as you would think that they should be, right?
Everybody should be.
But the police still had no leads. Nothing. All the tips that the police got were checked out, but nothing came to fruition. Mm-hmm. They were dead leads. So early morning on October 9th, a few miles from Buffalo, a worker with the water department spotted a man lying face down on the side of the road. Upon checking, the man found that this body was not breathing. Mm. So immediately he called the police. Police identified the body of 40-year-old cab driver Ernest Jones. Ernest was also bludgeoned, had his throat slit, and his heart cut out. They later found his blood-splattered taxi about 3 miles away. This was the sixth victim in less than 3 weeks in the Buffalo area. Now, police didn't know what to think. Was it one killer killing black men, or were there two killers out there? Either way, the community was screaming for answers, and there were no answers. There wasn't really any evidence.
Right. Well, they were a little bit different, too. Like, you wouldn't immediately connect them.
Right. I mean, they didn't even have any kind of subject to focus on. They had nothing. A $100,000 reward was offered for information leading to the arrest of the killer. Soon the national papers were running the story. Everybody was tuned in to the Buffalo area to see what was going on. Even the president at the time, Jimmy Carter, declared it to be a federal case, which meant that the Buffalo police had the full resources of the FBI. Nope. Anything they needed from the FBI, they got.
Why was it a federal case?
Because it was causing so much panic.
Oh, it didn't cross state lines.
And it was, they dubbed it like a hate crime. Hate crimes?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So it fell into that hate crime, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So on the evening of October 10th, 37-year-old Colin Cole was recovering from an overdose in a Buffalo hospital. About the time visiting hours were about to be over, a man went to the nurse's station and asked where Colin's room was. He then entered the room and started strangling him with some sort of ligature. A nurse who happened to be walking by stopped the attack. She called security, but the killer escaped. And luckily, Colin survived. Actually, they just missed. And the guy, it was same description, white man, face, couldn't tell exactly who it was.
So to me, he had to know that guy. Like, he's in the hospital. You know where he is. You know his name.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like stalking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm going to tell you what the next... Just listen. This is when our buddy FBI profiler John Douglas is called in.
Oh, John.
Mm-hmm. Now, John looked at everything, and he believed that the murders were all connected except the attempted murder of Colin Cole. Hmm. Since the guy had asked specifically for Colin, he considered this man to be just your normal, everyday racist copycat.
And we've talked about that on the show, too, that, like, it's terrible. But if you're going to murder somebody and then you could ride on somebody else's coattails, like how easy that would be to try to not get attention drawn to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Terrible. The guy completely dressed the part. The composite sketch looked like your normal person.
Right.
You know, your normal, everyday white man. Hoodie, glasses, you know.
Yep.
It would be easy to fool anybody into thinking that that's who you were. So Douglas said that the first four murders were what's called a blitz-style attack. But the cab driver murders weren't. The killer spent more time with the bodies, and the killer was more filled, was brutal and just filled with rage. Mm-hmm. And there was so much overkill to those murders that the shootings just didn't have.
Yeah, so it was a passionate kill versus just a walk up and shoot you and then walk away.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. There's something different with those two. Douglas said that the 22 caliber killer would be an avid hunter with a string of menial jobs, probably between the ages of 25 and 35. He would also have an obsession with guns and the military. And if he was in the military, he would seek psychiatric care and possibly, if not already, be discharged. Right? Smart guy, this man. I'm telling you, it's all kind of this hoodoo voodoo stuff he's got going here.
Hoodoo voodoo. That's good. Mm-hmm. You should trademark that.
I should. Maybe we should get those on t-shirts. Hoodoo voodoo.
Honestly, that's pretty clever.
Yeah, we should get somebody to write that up for us. Draw some funny thing or that, something.
He or she's got that hoodoo voodoo. That's
They've
cute.
Got that hoodoo voodoo. We're going to go skip a little bit. Everything's quiet. This was in October. Everything's kind of quiet until Manhattan on December 22nd, 1990, a couple months later. Mm-hmm. Two black men were attacked with knives. Four more were stabbed and murdered within a 12-hour period, believe it or not.
Wow.
25-year-old John Adams was stabbed around 11:30 a.m. but survived. 32-year-old Ivan Frazier was attacked next about 2 hours later on the subway. He managed to deflect the blade with his hands, and he only suffered minor injuries. He described the man as white with brown hair wearing a blue jacket. Around 3:30, Luis Rodriguez, 19 years old, was attacked by a man demanding his wallet. The man stabbed Luis twice in the heart. Luis was rushed to the hospital, where he was able to tell police the perpetrator was a white man with brown hair in a blue jacket. Unfortunately, Luis died later that day, and he was the first murder of the day. At 6:50 p.m., 30-year-old Antoine Davis was stabbed to death. 4 hours later, 20-year-old Richard Renner was stabbed and killed.
Oh my God!
Finally, Carl Ramsey was stabbed to death near Madison Square Garden just before midnight.
This is all the same person?
All within 12 hours. Yes. God. From 11:30 a.m. to 12 a.m. that midnight that day. Yeah. So, of course, papers went crazy. This killer was called the Midtown Slasher. And remember, around this time, like a few weeks before, that's when John Lennon was shot in front of the Dakota Hotel.
Right, right. But that was, so they didn't ever, did they for a second think they were connected or not?
No, because I think Mark Chapman was immediately put into custody as soon as he killed John Lennon.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of a stalker.
But no, this was, 12 hours.
Yeah, that's
six. That's what, 6 and 12 hours? That's one every 2 hours? That's a lot. With the same MO, that's a lot. Yeah.
Like, a lot even for New York City, that amount.
Amazing.
Even if you're a racist pig.
I was watching the FBI show on there, and they were talking with the Ivan Frazier, and he said he saw a man on the other side of the subway speaking to a woman, and he was, like, kind of trying to pick her up, and the woman was just not into it, and so she just hurried up and left at the next stop, and the guy, you know, this Ivan Frazier, he kind of watched it all happen. And then when the woman left, he just went back to reading his paper. The next thing he knew, this guy went up and just stabbed him.
As he's sitting there? He's reading his paper and the guy?
Yeah. Yeah, he just stabbed him.
I can't wait to hear the end of this because, like, I don't get it. but okay.
No.
And the fact that he got away with that much?
Yeah.
Ooh-wee. Okay.
Unreal. So John Douglas was called in again. Now, he believed even though the weapon was different, the attacks were the same because it was blitz attack, surprise attack. And they also noticed that it was awful quiet in Buffalo between the last slashing from October 9th. So John Douglas was called in, and he believed even though the weapon was different, the attacks were the same.
Yeah, somebody took the train into the city with their weapon. Yeah.
And so the police in Buffalo were thinking, you know, after this attack happened on the 22nd, they're thinking, wow, you know what? It's been kind of quiet around here. I wonder if, you know, it's the same guy. Well, guess what? On December 29th, 31-year-old Roger Adams was stabbed in Buffalo. Then, December 30th, 26-year-old Wendell Barnes was stabbed in Rochester, New York. Three more men were stabbed on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Luckily, all five men survived.
Could you imagine being like, you're just minding your own business and somebody comes up and stabs you? Like, you would be so shocked.
Oh, yeah. One of the man, the last person, that Carl Ramsey, he didn't even realize he was stabbed at first. That's until
exactly. I don't think you would.
He was in the subway, and then he realized what happened, and then that's where he died.
Well, you know, you hear lots of people say that, like, they hear shots. And you don't even feel it because I guess
adrenaline, maybe.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt though because it's like, what? You know what I mean? Like, so you're getting shot and your body gets it. You hear it. You know, they'll always say that they thought they heard fire, like a firecracker or whatever. And it's actually them being shot.
Right. Just unreal. Although police continued to search for their killer and they believed that the stabbings and the shootings were all related, they just did not have any leads. Still did not have clues. That is until April of 1981. Army officials in Fort Benning, Georgia, called the police in Buffalo, stating that they had a man named Joseph Christopher in custody. He had been in the stockade after he stabbed a black soldier while in the shower. Now, Joseph had showed odd behavior before the attack. Joseph shaved his own head with a razor, completely off. He was convinced that the army was poisoning his food, and he showed up to formation wearing flip-flops.
That's going to be a problem for the drill sergeant. They're not going to like that. Ooh, just saying.
Yep. When he was placed in the stockade after the attack, he tried to castrate himself with a razor.
Oh, why?
Because then he was then put in the psych ward because he was schizophrenic.
Shoot yourself in the foot. My God. Don't do that.
Yeah. Well... And it was there in the psych ward that he told medical staff that he had murdered black men in Buffalo and in the New York area. He didn't know why he did it. He didn't know how many he actually killed. He just knew that he did because it was just something he had to do.
He was mentally ill, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So he wasn't really racist.
Right.
Or so you think.
Well, his friends swore that he wasn't racist whatsoever, but we'll get into that later. The detectives in Buffalo obtain a warrant and go to search Joseph Christopher's last known address, which is his mother's home. When they searched it, they found clothing that matched what the witnesses had described. They found the wire glasses, all the khakis that he wore, the sweatshirts, which, you know, honestly, if you would search my husband's room, you'd find a hooded sweatshirt, you'd find khakis.
I was just thinking that sounds just like my daughter and my son.
Yeah, exactly. In the basement, they found an indoor shooting range with boxes of .22 caliber ammunition, a gun barrel, two sawed-off rifle stocks, and a bunch of other guns. It seemed that basically Joseph Christopher's father was an avid hunter, and when he passed, Joseph inherited all of his father's guns. Authorities then learned that Christopher had joined the army on November 13th, arriving at Fort Benning 6 days later. He was absent on leave in December 19th to January 4th, and he had a bus ticket recording his arrival in Manhattan on December 20th. So this all tells us why there was no more Mm-hmm. This, when there wasn't any shootings or stabbings, he was in the military, he was on leave, you know.
Right. Made the timeline.
Exactly. 4 days after Christopher Joseph's mother's home was searched, he was charged with three of the Buffalo shooting deaths. A fourth count of murder was added to the list on June 29th, plus charges related to the non-fatal stabbings in Buffalo in December of 1980 and January 1981. New York City indictments were being returned in for the murder of Louis Rodriguez and the non-fatal stabbing of Ivan Frazier. Joseph Christopher pleaded not guilty and refused counsel by his lawyers that were hired by his mother because he wanted to represent himself. And we all know that is not a good idea.
Oh, buddy. Nope.
He was found guilty and sentenced to 60 years in prison. But this was later overturned because the trial judge had barred the defense from presenting expert psychiatric testimony about Joseph's ability to stay in trial. Basically, he wasn't sane enough to stay in trial. So he did spend some time at the psychiatric ward. And then in 1985, Joseph was later found competent to stay in trial. And then when he did, he was then sentenced to life in prison. And on March of 1993... Joseph died at the age of 33 from a rare form of breast cancer while he was in Attica Correctional Facility. Now, let's get into a little bit about Joseph, because he's fairly interesting here. Joseph Gerard Christopher was born in Buffalo, New York on July 26, 1955. He was the only son of Therese and Nicholas Christopher. His mother was a registered nurse, and his father was a maintenance worker at the city's sanitation department. Joseph had two older sisters and one younger sister. Now, his dad was an avid hunter and an outdoorsman, and he shared his passion with Joseph. Joseph learned how to shoot and handle weapons at a very young age, and his friends said that Joseph loved the outdoors more than anything else. Now, what did our friend John Douglas say? John Douglas said he would be an avid hunter.
I'm passionate for guns is what I was going to say, but kind of the same. Okay.
Well, yeah, he was an avid hunter and he loved guns. Joseph enrolled at a vocational high school in the automotive mechanics program in 1971. He was a very quiet kid. Of course he was. And he did do well in shop courses, but he did drop out in 1974. He was said to be very intelligent, although not book smart. Kind of like you and I, right?
Kind of like me.
He worked a bunch of odd jobs. Menial jobs, I might add, which was another thing that John Douglas said, before becoming a maintenance man at a college up in Buffalo. And there he worked the midnight shift. He then was fired on March 1979 for sleeping on the job and had to go back and live with his parents. Now, a lot of people believe that Joseph did not commit the murders. They say there's very little evidence and that he didn't resemble the composite sketch. But nobody... And everybody resembles the composite sketches. Trust me, they're just normal. Many of his friends felt that this was not the Joseph that they knew. He didn't have any criminal record or even a history of violence. Joseph did make a vague confession in 1983 in an interview, and there he did talk about the murders, but yet he didn't go into, he was just very vague about everything, even about the taxicab murders. And then when they pressed him about whether or not he took the hearts of the cab drivers, he just would shut up and he'd refuse to answer any more questions. But he did know details of those murders that no one else but the killer would know.
So he did.
And, well, it's thought, although nobody was ever charged for those murders, they're putting it on him that he did commit the murders. Mm-hmm. In 2017, a woman by the name of Catherine Palerno wrote a book about Joseph Christopher's killing spree entitled Absolute Madness. In an interview with The Lineup, Catherine states that even though Joseph's crimes were considered to be racially motivated, his friends and family, both black and white, say that Joseph was not racist at all and he had never shown any racial animosity whatsoever. And although everything was very complex, the bottom line was that Joseph Christopher developed paranoid schizophrenia.
That's what I would say. He was sick. So
he was sick. The book goes on to say how he was deeply affected by his father's death in 1976. And in 1979, he mentioned to his friends and family that he felt something was really wrong with his brain. And he told his ex-girlfriend, quote, "I'm nutsed up." He was really depressed and socially withdrawn. He did seek help at a Buffalo psychiatric center early in September 1980, but was dismissed after a 30-minute interview. And that was just a few weeks prior to the first killing spree.
30 minutes? You can't find out what somebody's favorite color is in 30 minutes.
Well, I could, but
no,
still.
But you know what I
know.
I mean.
30 like minutes isn't enough. If you go into a hospital and you say, listen, I'm really, they should keep you longer than 30 minutes.
Yeah, totally.
Another interview with crimetraveler.org, Catherine said that, quote, when Joseph was finally treated with antipsychotic medication, he responded to it well. The medication stabilized him and it seemed to bring him back to himself, so to speak. When he was medicated, he expressed not only remorse, but shock at the things he had done and said.
So he did do it.
Yeah. I don't think he actually was in his right mind when he did it. I think he really did have
psychosis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad because you wonder, you know, if they would have kept him in and they would have treated him, maybe those men would still be alive.
30 minutes? Like, 30 minutes. I've spent longer in the McDonald's drive-thru line.
I know. It's shameful.
No, it is. Terrible.
It's shameful. But what can you do? Hopefully policies have changed. And I don't know the reasoning. Maybe they had cutbacks. Maybe they just didn't.
Maybe he came across okay, too. Like, he could, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
He sold it.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, there you have it. That's the 22 caliber killer slash the Midtown slasher. All the same person.
Well, I'm going to pull a Jennifer here and say I've never heard of him, which means
I know.
Something. That means something because I haven't. Huh.
I know. And it was right after the 44 caliber killer, which was Son of Sam. They have a certain look. Huh. Let me put it that way.
Well, and then the Arthur Shaw Cross in Rochester. That happened then, too. So up there.
Could you imagine the terror everybody felt?
Oh, couldn't be female, couldn't be a black guy, like, and you couldn't be a couple making out in a car. Terrible. Woo. All right, well, good job, Jen. And I guess this is our finale, our final.
It is.
And speaking of finals, we're not going to have any because we have so much snow here. We had a snow day today. Gonna have a snow day tomorrow.
Yeah,
you already do. Your school already called off.
Oh, your school will be called off soon.
Oh yeah, I know.
That's a matter of time.
Can't even see the road. So.
And actually, we will not be back until January 8th.
That's why you
are taking
all of these. Take a day off. Take a day off. You know what I mean? Then listen.
Yep.
Take a day off. It'll last you.
They'll last you. We will be back on January 8th with brand new, exciting crime. And we want to thank everybody for listening to us this year. We really appreciate you.
We do. Oh, shoot. Should we give thank yous to people? I don't know. Thank you. That's all
thank
I got.
You. Big thank you. Big thank you for Edward October. He is
still
amazing. We love him with all his heart. Our heart. He is like our first big bestie in the podcasting world.
All our Patreons. Thank you.
We wouldn't be possible without you.
Yeah.
We know you guys all know how we feel about Nico.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be possible without Nico, believe me. He is our saving grace.
Truth.
And
Truth.
His birthday, actually, his birthday is December 30th. So we want all of you to tweet out at We Talk of Dreams, happy birthday on December 30th.
Aw.
Our little boy's growing up. Sunrise, sunset. Yes. So, but yes, thank you. We want to wish everybody happy holidays. We love you more than words can say.
More than words.
Anyway.
Too loopy. Too much of this stuff. All right, buddy. Well, guess what? Remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya, and we'll see you in 2020. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.